At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague, Professor John Yu. He is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. In addition, he's a non-resident senior fellow of the American Enterprise Institute, and most importantly, distinguished visiting scholar, School of Civic Leadership, University of Texas at Austin. That is the Civitas Institute. Writing most recently for the non-legal audience, that's me, at least I understand history, with his colleague Robert Delahunty in National Affairs about a case that we're on the eve of hearing oral arguments before the Supreme Court. There are actually two cases, the professor guides me. There is the matter of a federal district judge, a distinguished position in the globe, issuing a temporary restraining order that is not only for the presenters in his court, but nationwide. And that leads to the second issue to be argued, I guess, coterminously or simultaneously, the Trump administration's decision to end birthright citizenship. These run together. The court is hearing within hours both. Professor, a very good evening to you. I ask a fundamental non-legal question from the outside. How is it that these two cases meet or to be integrated before the court? Are they trying to save time or do they belong together? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, and great to be with you. Thanks for having me back. I hope people realize how important this is and how unusual the oral arguments tomorrow are. The Supreme Court actually finished up its calendar for oral arguments several weeks ago. And by now, they're usually hard at work writing opinions, responding to each other, dissenting, and getting ready for the announcement of the opinions, which generally take place now over the next month. But breaking from their usual pattern, they have scheduled an extraordinary session tomorrow morning to hear these questions. And so that, I think, gives you a sense of how important these questions are to the court, of course, to the Trump administration, and to those who are challenging the Trump administration. The reason why, John, you ask an excellent question. The reason why both of these important issues are coming up is the way that the birthright citizenship question comes to the Supreme Court. You have several federal district judges around the country who have blocked President Trump's executive order. But they didn't just do it with regard to the people in the courtroom in front of them. Right? People who, for example, say, I was born in the United States. My parents might have been illegal aliens, but still I should order the State Department to give me a passport or order the Social Security Administration to recognize me and give me a card. Instead, those judges went farther and put a ban on the Trump administration from following this policy nationwide with regard to everyone in the country, not just the people who sued. That's what we call a nationwide injunction. That power that these district judges have been exercising has really stymied the Trump administration in a great many other areas, not just immigration, but also impoundment, the spending power, efforts by President Trump to reduce federal spending, efforts by President Trump to reduce the size of the federal bureaucracy, even to get rid of some agencies, to stop giving out grants to universities who he claims are engaged in racist behavior. All of these have been blocked by judges under this nationwide injunction, claimed nationwide injunction power. The Trump administration is challenging the authority of judges to go beyond just the people who appear in the courtroom. But at the same time, the merits of we think of that in the law as the procedural question, but the procedural question is just the thing you answer on the way to the substantive issue, which is, can the president actually say, no, not everyone born in the United States is a citizen. Actually, people who are here as illegal aliens, if their children are born on our territory, they can't become automatically citizens. And that is a huge constitutional issue, right? As President Trump will probably say, it's huge. It's one of fundamental importance about how you interpret the Constitution, what the purpose of certain constitutional texts and amendments are, but also how do we as a country define who is part of the body politic?
As the president would say, it's a beautiful constitution, but yes. I learned from you, there's one but. It does not define citizenship. I did not know this until I read your paper. What does that mean for everything that's happened between the 18th century and the 21st?
It's a remarkable issue, oversight perhaps, that I think most Americans were unaware of until the Supreme Court arguments will be taking place tomorrow. The Constitution, as originally drafted, did not define citizenship. All it said was that the Congress can set the rules of naturalization, and it required that the president be a natural-born citizen. That's it. And so one reason we are debating this issue today is because from the founding of the country until and through the Civil War, the national government had no definition of citizenship and would rely generally on the states to admit people and give them citizenship. The problem was in the notorious decision of Dred Scott, Chief Justice Taney said, despite the fact the Constitution doesn't define citizenship, despite the fact that Congress and the states have worked out this system, he held that blacks could never become citizens of the United States, not just slaves, but also the freed slaves in the North. That was one of the issues that precipitated the Civil War. And so after the Civil War, the Republican Congress enacted and then sent to the states the 14th Amendment for ratification. And that amendment says, if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen. It overturned Dred Scott. It made clear that slaves, freed slaves, blacks, everyone born on the territory of the country was automatically a citizen. But there's also a qualifying clause. It says you're born in the United States, you're a citizen, and you have to be subject to the jurisdiction thereof of the United States. That phrase, which is also not defined in the Constitution, creates the opening for President Trump to say, well, if you're here illegally, then you're not subject to our jurisdiction. You still have allegiance to some foreign power, and so therefore your children don't benefit from birthright citizenship. That has not been the practice. I think actually for roughly, you know, the history of the country, we have generally followed a birthright citizenship rule. But President Trump, I think, legitimately is trying to change the interpretation of the Constitution and trying to persuade the courts to agree with him.
I learned from your presentation that we need to now turn to a Latin phrase that's used instead of saying all this out in English, just solely. What does that mean?
That basically means law of the place of your birth, jus soli. Yeah, so that's the reference to birthright citizenship. It is the rule that Great Britain had at the time of the Revolution. And one interesting historical question is when we broke away, when the states broke away and formed the United States, we basically took most of the British law with us. Even though we rebelled against them, we accepted and incorporated British law into our basic law when we started. And so most states, I think all states, let me rephrase that, all states continue this jus soli idea that we got from the British, that if you're born on American territory, you are an American citizen. The question becomes, did the framers of the 14th Amendment, did they want to alter that to take into account immigration, to take into account people who are not in the country legally? Without that qualification, I think everyone would agree that jus soli plus the 14th Amendment makes clear everyone born in the United States is a citizen.
We come to a bump in the road here because we're on our way to saying it's okay. In the Declaration of Independence, I've never seen this presented as a legal advantage. How is it? How does it apply here?
This is a great question, John, a fundamental question, maybe the most fundamental question of our constitutional law, which means that's not just for the Supreme Court to think about and decide. It's for you and me and our fellow citizens, which is what role does the Declaration of Independence play? What legal effect does the Declaration of Independence have? Do courts have to give it life? Right? When the Declaration says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and all men are created equal. So one question about the Declaration of Independence is it marks the break from Great Britain. Right? We do the most extraordinary, unprecedented thing in world history. We break away from the mother country. That never happened before. When that happened, did it reset citizenship? Because until the Declaration of Independence, everybody here was a British citizen. How did it work? And so one argument, the people who President Trump is relying on would say, what happened at that moment is that the United States and its citizens had to mutually consent to their relationship. And so they would say then, and then what happened after that to today is we're just saying illegal aliens are here without the consent of the government because they're breaking our laws by being here. And so you don't have this social compact between them and the state the way the United States and its citizens do. Now, the other question about the Declaration of Independence, though, is it also recognizes a lot of natural law, British law concepts that we incorporate, that we start with. And the Constitution has a lot of words in it that actually don't have definition and that we look to British law to help us interpret, like impeachment, for example, or the executive power, for example, or commerce. You know, a lot of the most important constitutional phrases don't have a thesaurus attached to them. They require us to look at British law of the time to understand them. And so one of the things we have long thought is that the definition of citizenship came with the British law into American law at the time of the Declaration of Independence, too. Sorry for that long-winded answer, but no. I get really excited talking about the Declaration of Independence.
No, it's helpful to me because I learned from you that the Declaration of Independence has weight, if you want it to be weighty, because they were no longer British citizens. They renounced their citizenship and formed a completely new enterprise. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the English common law that they're inheriting from the early 17th century has to be either amended or agreed to by the new citizens in the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't see in your presentation that is taken into account by those who defend that birthright citizenship.
Yes, that's exactly right, John. That's my argument in the piece you mentioned. Thanks for mentioning it, by the way, is that in a way, this is a debate about how was citizenship handled at the beginning. And so if the Declaration is also part of incorporating British concepts, right, in defense of freedom, in the defense of the freedom of the United States and, its citizens, if that is the rule that's brought over, use solely, and then it continues in practice, and it's Dred Scott and Chief Justice Taney that broke that practice, then you could interpret the 14th Amendment, as I do, as just a restoration of birthright citizenship and making sure that it now applies to blacks and the freed slaves. So to me, it seems strange that you would do that and then also introduce for the first time this idea that if you came into the country illegally, your children don't benefit from birthright. I think that's the hard argument to make, but that's what you need to do to overturn what seems to me, two centuries of unbroken practice.
The word allegiance pops up several times in your piece, and I believe it was part of the argument in the English common law, allegiance as well. Is that strikes me as significant. We are having examples all the time of men who've entered the United States with bad intentions and bad conduct. It's a major controversy. El Salvador is involved. It's very romantic. It goes on a bit. Their allegiance has to be challenged. And therefore, the children of those men and women, it's not a clear case of allegiance, is it?
I think that's an excellent point, John. And I could see the question today, and we're long past the 14th Amendment. today they could not anticipate these problems we have today. Right? The one thing about the time of the 14th Amendment was the country wanted people to move here.
Right. Right?
We didn't even have immigration laws until 20 years later. So this idea of illegal being an illegal alien didn't really exist at the time of the 14th Amendment. We didn't think that way. But you're quite right. As a matter of policy now, things have really changed. As you say, we have people coming to the country. Regardless of what you think about President Trump providing enough due process to these Venezuelan gang members,
right,
as you said, who've been sent to El Salvador, many of them are very bad people, right? They have extensive criminal records, not just in Venezuela, but when they get here. They have committed crimes and even gone to the point of occupying apartment buildings. And, you know, they've been designated a foreign terrorist group. And so this is something I think that the framers of the 14th Amendment in 1868 couldn't anticipate, is large amounts of immigration that violates our laws. And so, and they don't give up their allegiance to Venezuela or El Salvador. They're not here to become Americans. And so it's a legitimate question as a matter of policy. Well, why should their children become citizens automatically when their parents show every desire not to be part of our body politic?
I'm speaking with Professor John Yu, and we've set up what the problem is. When we come back, I'm going to ask the professor to look at the court and tell us which way it may be leaning, if any.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.